Once forged in the fires of PR and journalism, Curtis Dewar and Corey Westbrook united to create C Squared. Then I jumped on the bandwagon. I'm your host, Aaliyah, and this is Heavy Business, a podcast where we talk to music industry professionals and musicians and learn together about the music industry, marketing, and other tools that can help you promote the music you put so much effort into creating. Hello and welcome. This is Heavy Business. I'm Aaliyah.
And I'm Curtis.
And today we are here with Dean Lamb from Archspire. Hell yeah. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh my goodness. No problem. I'm in the magical lands of Sweden right now. It's a very magical year.
I imagine. Yeah, you're right in the middle of your tour right now with Psychroptic, Benighted, and Entheos. And as soon as you get home, pretty much, you're going on tour for North America with Whitechapel, Signs of the Swarm, and Entheos. In honor of the press release, will you be eating a lot of White Castle on the North America tour?
We definitely try not to eat too much of that kind of stuff, but sometimes it's all you get. But I'm currently in Europe, which is the land of inconvenience. There is nothing convenient about Europe. Whereas in America, everything is right at your fingertips. You can go to a big store that sells absolutely everything. And I'm really looking forward to the convenience of that. So we might hit up White Castle once or twice.
Just in honor of the press release there. Go ahead, Curtis.
They don't have them in Canada. So, I mean, I've been to the U.S. numerous times and I've never tried it. So good for you.
Oh yeah, they're tiny little sandwiches. They're fine. I don't know.
They're okay. Like I always say, yeah. With White Castle, it's kind of like depends on when you first had it in your life. If you had it when you were younger and you have a nostalgic association with it, you like it. But if you eat it for the first time as an adult, nobody ever likes it. But
that's
yeah.
<quite true. laughs>
We've got a little bit of lag here due to the Wi-Fi, but we are definitely trucking through. And
We're going to truck through.
Yeah. I want to dive in a little bit. As we mentioned, we're a podcast that focuses a lot on the business side of music. And we, as such, tend to push bands to use social media and do the content creation thing a lot. Archspire really does this well, I feel, and I wanted to ask you how you balance your quality over quantity when it comes to content creation and when there's such a demand for quantity.
I think the most important thing when it comes to creating content for your band is the core idea of it. So if you have a great idea, it's going to do well. And if you have great execution on that idea, it's going to do really well. But if you just do content for content's sake, it almost always comes across as disingenuous. So for us, we like to sit around and just riff on ideas. Someone has an idea for something stupid, makes us laugh. We go, you know what? That made us laugh. Maybe we can turn that into something everybody can enjoy. A great example of that is we love Shreds videos. These types of videos where you have a live performance of a band, and you replace the audio with just the absolute worst sounding audio that you can think of. And it was an idea that I had a long time ago. You know what? I would love to do one of those for our band, or have someone do one. And we were in the middle of writing our album Relentless Mutation. So this is about 6 or 7 years ago. And we thought, you know what? Let's take 2 weeks off of writing and just give ourselves a break and just focus 100% on this really stupid idea. And we went absolutely all in. I think it did quite well.
It was so good. I was crying laughing.
Oh, that's great. You know, okay, great. The core idea was sound, and the execution, then we obsess over it just like we obsess over everything else. So it's going to do well. We had a video come out recently. I guess not recently now, but a year ago, year and a half ago, where we had our moms watch our very gory death metal video. And this is an idea that our vocalist Ollie had, I don't even know, 10 years ago, maybe, like a long time ago. He thought, you know, it'd be cool if we got our moms to review our album, because moms are always so supportive. So you get your moms to review it. It'll be all 10 out of 10, of course.
Yep.
So we said, you know, we have this new piece of content coming out. We have this new music video. Let's put it in the hands of our moms and just watch the reaction and film it. And, you know, we finally found the right thing for them to watch. And that was the video. And again, great idea, great core concept. It's an idea you can distill down to a single sentence. Our moms watch our gory death metal video. It's just such a winning idea, you know, and they don't always come around every day. It takes a while. Sometimes you really have to massage the idea, but for us, a great idea, mixed with some serious dedicated application or production or whatever that idea, it's usually going to win out and make some pretty awesome content.
Speaking of like patience, you guys waited like around 10 years to put out your first music video as a band. Can you kind of explain that a little bit? I'm like, it was such a great video, but I feel like there's got to be a story behind why you waited.
We hated music videos for so long because we thought that they were just kind of bland and kind of boring. We thought, you know what? What are we going to do? Us playing in a graveyard or an abandoned building or whatever, and then the storyline is going to be some guy running away from something. We just never had a good idea.
It's got to be a woman running away from something in the woods.
I actually was going to say that, but it sounded even too cliche for me to say that, so I changed it. But yeah, you're right. It's always some woman running away, and it's just seemed kind of like we're over it. We're like, but we're sitting in the van one day. And for anybody who hasn't seen it, it's basically this idea where everybody in the band is being experimented on. So we're being subjected to crazy audio waves, crazy weird chemicals. We're strapped to, you know, big torture devices. And then at the end of the video, the whole culmination of it, the whole climax of the video, our heads blow up and our faces melted and all that kind of stuff. Now, it came out of an idea of us in the van. We're sitting, driving down the highways. You know what? A video would be kind of cool. What if we do one where, I don't know, like our heads blow up or whatever? And that was the only idea we had. Now, our vocalist, Ollie, his partner, she works in film in Vancouver, where we're from. And she worked on the John Cena show. So it was a Peacemaker, I believe it's called. And they had this rig where you put a head on top of it, a fake head, and it blows it up. And so he's like, you know, we could use this. So all we had for an idea for maybe 2 months is our heads blow up. And that's just not enough, you know? So from there, we massaged it, found the right guy to direct it, massaged it, put a lot of money into it. And I think it turned out great. That's the reason we just didn't have a good core idea. And now that we've done a video that people seem to like, we're now venturing very, very deep into that avenue with our new video that's going to be coming up quite soon. Much grander, much larger, much higher budget, a much bigger crew, a bigger cast. I think it's going to be seriously the craziest video ever made, in my opinion.
I have a question just about that, just about budgeting and stuff like that. How do you kind of justify your costs when you're in the planning stages of making a video?
I wish I had an answer for you there.
Fair.
Oh, man. We sat around many, many days and go, okay, we want to do a music video. The album's already out. So already we're sort of at a disadvantage because we're not putting it out as a single. We're putting it out as a sort of an afterthought. But that can be cool. So who cares? So we'll put out a video for a song that's already out. It's all good. But when the budget started hitting $60,000, we said, yeah, is this really worth, you know, almost a mortgage for a house? Like, is this for a down payment for a house? Like, is this really worth it? And then it started creeping up and up and up. And it got to about $80,000. And we said, yeah, I don't know if we're all totally comfortable with that. Because that's a lot of money for a band like us.
Yep.
I'm sure it's a lot of money for any band, really. So the idea was, well, you know what? Why don't we get some supporters, offer some exclusive rewards, and we'll do a Kickstarter and we'll crowdfund some stuff and make it a little bit easier, soften the blow a little bit. And so we put up this crowdfund and we raised $83,000. Now, the reason why that was so successful is because we had a very distilled idea. We want to make the craziest death metal music video ever made. We have very amazing supportive fans. And we have a very clear idea of what we want to do. And so with all that put together, along with a lot of consideration on the logistical side and a lot of consideration on what the rewards could be. And, you know, we put together some things. We have our band motto is Stay Tech. So we put together a gold Stay Tech medallion, an actual gold medallion that was up for offer. We also had the option to come in and fly in and be in the music video. And so there's a lot of things that we put together we thought would be very exciting for people. And halfway through the campaign, we had to double all of our stuff. We had to double the amount of slots available for the medallion, for the t-shirts, for the post, double everything, because it was the reaction was so huge. And again, the reason why it was so successful, in my opinion, was because we had a very simple, distilled idea. This is what we want to do. We have very supportive fans. And now as for justifying it, there's no way to truly know. If we're going to have fun, we want to do cool stuff. Man, it was so cool. Some of the most fun I've, and once it's out, I hope you'll agree that it just, it's worth, I think it's worth it. It's going to be pretty amazing.
Well, we got a little bit of a garbled response there. I think we had a struggle with the Wi-Fi. But I caught that in the end, you hope it will be, we will see that it was worth it.
Okay, here, let me sum it up one more time. Money, scary. Spending money, very scary. I hope it worked out.
I have faith that it did, because I know Drone Corps Aviator was crazy. And I know all my friends were telling me about it after I'd already heard about it. So,
yeah. Also, one more just question.
Oh, that's great.
One more question on the video, Dean, which is just, so if crowdfunding hadn't existed, what would you guys have done, do you think?
We would have spent the money.
You would have done it?
We were fully prepared to spend the money anyway.
Cool.
If I'm being honest,
we lost you again. We'll give it a second for you to come back. I feel like when you're doing a Kickstarter campaign, it's so important to actually, that's one of the keys, is actually to be prepared to spend the money anyway and to have everything set up in advance. Dean, you want to try again? completely frozen.
Hopefully we can get him back. I'm going to pause this for a second, Olivia. Hold on. If you want to re-say that answer, Dean, that would be amazing.
Okay, so the last question that that you asked was, what would you have done before crowdfunding?
What would you have done if crowdfunding didn't exist? Would you have spent the money?
Yeah, so if crowdfunding didn't exist, we actually already spent the money. The crowdfunding was just to recover it. So it was just on the off chance that maybe people wanted to be part of it. So we had already spent it. So it was sort of, it wasn't like an afterthought. It was more like, let's try to get some of it back. We were totally happy to get back 10,000 out of the $80,000 budget. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a big, big endeavor. So I think people are going to like it though.
Fair enough.
I was just saying, I think that's almost one of the keys to having a successful crowdfunding campaign is spending the money in advance and really being invested in your idea that much, and then offering the opportunity for people to be a part of it after the fact.
Yeah. Well, we have a band. He's not quite a manager. He's basically our assistant. His name is Miles, and he's a very nice man. And he spent some time going to some conventions where they board game conventions, where they do a lot of crowdfunding. And board games on Kickstarter and Indiegogo and all that are very, very popular and very successful. So he talked to some people that had done successful crowdfunding things, and he came at it with a pretty nuanced insight as to how to make it work really well. And I think that's a big reason why it was so successful.
Sure, I could totally see that. So right now, you're on a headlining tour in Europe that you guys planned yourselves, it sounds like, based off of this video that I just recently watched. Excellent video on touring on your YouTube channel.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thanks for making it. One thing you mentioned is the importance of having the right crew. And I wanted to ask how you got connected with your current tour manager.
So there is, who is your audience? Mostly musicians, I assume.
I would say it's mostly musicians. It's a mix of musicians and other industry people.
Okay. So, there's a really important thing to being in a band. It's having the right team. And I'm sure many people can sort of relate to that. The band can really only do so much before it interferes with making music. So the band can't drive 100% of the time on tour. Band can't mix themselves on stage. Band can't sell their own merch every single night and do all those things all the time. So you need to build up this team. And before COVID, we had some great people that we were working with, great drivers, great merch guys, great tour manager, front of house. Front of house engineer, somebody who mixes us on stage, basically. And after COVID, everybody quit. Everybody stopped doing it because they said, I'm going to go get a regular job because the stability for the job just wasn't there. So when touring kind of kicked back in, we went, oh shit, we have nobody to work with. We have a friend, his name is Brett Bamberger. He plays in a band, Revocation. And Revocation is a death metal band. And they're very influential to us in a lot of ways, both musically and business-wise. And their bass player, Brett, he is kind of like the guy. A lot of people look at that guy and go, man, that dude is the business guy. He creates huge spreadsheets that all bands now use, all our friends use, on tour for selling and keeping track of merch. He has all the currency exchange ideas. He has all of, he just, if you ask him something, he's like, oh, here's what we do. And it's awesome. So we needed somebody. We reached out and he said, oh, I got a guy to run front of house. So mix us on stage and also manage the tour. Problem is he's literally never done it before. So this guy has never tour managed and never been on tour before. But Brett said, you know what? He's good. And if Brett thinks he's good, then we're going to be pretty confident that he's going to be good, even though he wasn't tested at all. We did a tour with him the first day, and I love the guy. He had a panic attack and freaked out and had to go to the hospital because it was just so much stuff.
Everywhere. Yeah, the first time, I mean, I can only imagine.
Yeah. Not to mention the tour was much, much bigger than we thought it was going to be. So lots of people, new band. He's a big fan of the band. He wants to do a good job. He's also tour managing, you know, a total of four bands through the whole. It's an unbelievable amount of work. Through that tour, we developed this great relationship with him where we realized his TMing, tour managing skills are so valuable to us on tour that we now can almost not live without that comfort and that knowing that someone has our back when it comes to looking over contracts, when it comes to making sure the schedule is all good, all that kind of stuff. So in between tours, we thought, you know what? We would love someone to help do day-to-day stuff. And he seems like kind of like the right kind of guy. So now we have him monthly, basically doing our day-to-day business. And I talk to him all the time. And having a band assistant is so amazing. I literally never thought about doing that before. We've had managers before, but we've never really had anything long-term. But with this sort of structure, you have some of the benefits of a manager, but you also have so many benefits to just clear up your day so you can be creative. Because being in a band, at the end of the day, the creativity, the artistic output is a big part of the selling package. That's what you need to sell is your creative output. So having somebody in the background running a lot of that stuff is unbelievably helpful. So yeah, that's how we met him. And it's been pretty awesome. He's here with us right now. He's killing it. This is his first time, first real time in Europe. He went to Europe once when he was in school, just into Italy, but it's his first time tour managing in Europe, his first time touring in Europe. It's his second tour overall. And everybody in the tour package is like, well, that guy's doing a really good job. So, yeah, he's pretty good. He's pretty good.
Awesome. So how is that different than managing you guys, just out of curiosity? Not quite clear on that point.
A manager typically works within a framework of a percentage of gross.
Oh, I see where you're coming from now. Okay.
Yeah. And as a band our size, to give away 10, 15%, sometimes 20% of gross, 20% of net, depends on kind of the manager.
Yeah.
That is another member of the band. That is crazy. I'm not saying it's not worth it, but for us, at the point where we are at in our band, we just couldn't justify that. So, and also we're a very low maintenance band. We do a lot of stuff our own. So we have merchandise companies, we have booking agencies, we have business manager, we have in Canada, we work within the Canadian Factor grant system. So Factor Canada writes grants, or you write grants to Factor Canada and they, you know, approve or deny non-recoupable grants for Canadian musicians. And that's been very helpful. So we have a lot of connections and we have a lot of groundwork kind of set up. We just need somebody to help us manage the day-to-day. He seemed to be the right fit.
Makes sense. Aaliyah, can I go on to another question, or did you want to ask?
Sure, go ahead.
So just in regards to business type stuff, so can you kind of go over any red flags that people should be aware of in terms of, contracts or anything like that stick out for you?
The big thing that we've learned is, and this is my opinion, but it's based in some experience. If you are a newer band, contracts are almost never in your favor. If you don't have the fan base, then you don't have the leverage. So when a manager or a booking agent comes to you or a label and they give you a contract, be really skeptical about everything in there. One of the big things that you get caught with managers, and luckily we haven't been, I'm not saying all managers are bad. There's plenty of amazing managers, amazing booking agents, super helpful labels, but there are plenty on the other side of that as well. There's one horror story that I keep hearing over and over again, and that's a sunset clause within a management contract. And that stuff is a little scary, especially when you assign with the wrong manager, you dissolve the contract, but they still get a certain percentage every month for 10 years, 20 years, whatever the contract is. That stuff is scary. One thing that we learned early on, don't sign contracts with managers. It should be a good faith deal. At least in the level that our band is at and below, it should be in good faith. The same thing with booking agents. Everybody should be working together until it doesn't make sense. And then when it doesn't make sense, it should feel like that for both parties. And then that's when you should end it. Now with a label, it's a little bit different because everything needs to be laid out totally explicitly. If you want to go with a label, you are going to trade so much of your income for the reach and the opportunity and the capital, the investment. And you have to really weigh your options there. I find that when you're signing with a label at first, you need to imagine, okay, what do they have that we can't do on our own? And if you're a brand new band, that's probably a lot that they have that you don't know how to do on your own, or you don't have the ability to do. But when you get further and further along in your career, you can kind of make that decision and go, okay, well, now do you really need all that? Or have we learned enough? We have enough income to kind of kickstart on our own. It's a big question. There's a lot of people that are wanting to take advantage of younger bands. And it's kind of scary.
Understood. And then I wanted to talk just briefly about Junos and stuff. Would you want to go over, well, I mean, a lot of the Americans don't know what the Junos are. So basically it's like the Canadian equivalent of the Grammys for anybody listening. Yeah. So can you go over how that has helped, or if it's hindered you guys in any way with that exposure?
We were nominated for a Juno in 2017 or in 2018 for our album Relentless Mutation. Mm-hmm. We played a show in Vancouver after we were nominated, after the award ceremony. We saw a bunch of people come in to the show in a small venue in Vancouver that were very obviously not metalheads. And we went, what the hell? No, what are you doing here? Like, this is weird. Great show. Time went on. We got nominated for another one. We did not expect to win. We did win. The most beneficial thing from that was all of our parents now realize that we are a legitimate band.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Anytime you get your face in a newspaper, your aunt goes, I keep seeing you in the newspaper. You know, these kinds of things are amazing. Now, did they do a lot for our band? I'm not sure. It's kind of yet to be seen. I have a very pretty statue in my closet.
Nice.
I'm nervous to put it out anywhere because I don't want it to have to loom over me. Like, you better write more awesome music that people like, you know, it's kind of scary. But yeah, the whole system is kind of interesting because it's built up on, people that are in the metal music scene in Canada, and we know a lot of them. And so after we won that award, we heard from some of them. We said, yeah, I voted for you. It's like, hey, you and I did shows together 10 years ago. I see why you voted for us. It's, you like us. It's not even a popularity contest. It's just, it's almost like who you know kind of thing, but very amazing. And I think the nomination is just as much press as you would ever need. Because just being nominated as being an extreme metal band, and we were nominated alongside Brand of Sacrifice, Spirit Box, like extreme bands and very modern sounding.
Yep.
And that's super cool. I love that Canada is sort of recognizing that kind of stuff.
We'll ask you a question before Aaliyah asks any other questions, which is, so how do I want to put this? Does it affect anything outside of Canada? I saw the odd article, but like, does anybody care outside of Canada? Out of curiosity, I actually don't know. I'm not trying to be a dick. I really don't know.
I don't know. I mean, I think people, we've gotten people messaging us from other parts of the world.
Fair.
I think it's amazing. I think, you know, the Juno, so it's Caris, Caris, I think is the company, or the government subsidiary or whatever that puts it on it. And I love the fact that they do that and they spotlight musicians, and it's amazing. And I love to be in a country that does that. I don't know if it necessarily, pushed us in any direction, but we've definitely heard people talk about it. But it didn't necessarily open up any doors for us in terms of touring or anything.
And I guess not radio either. I don't really see you guys as being a radio band.
I might have to check on that one, actually.
You don't know? Did?
Okay. I don't know.
Cool.
Yeah, I haven't checked our publishing lately, but cool. Maybe. Yeah, cool. Maybe it did.
Okay, cool. Well, that was my final Juno question, Aaliyah.
Well, like you said, you guys are multi-skilled. You wear a lot of hats in the band, and you guys do a lot for yourselves. And I assume there was like some point in time where you started bringing on help, or maybe it was kind of like an organic process, like gradual, but what was the first non-band member staff sort of crew that you brought on, and what made you decide to bring in outside help?
We did 12 years ago, we did a Canadian tour and we had a driver / manager come along with us. And he was not really getting paid to do it. He was more just, he owned a label and they kind of released our first album kind of. And he just kind of helped with driving. So it's been pretty much our entire band's career hiring people or having people come out and help us, you know, just because they're excited about doing it. But gradually it sort of became like a, well, free stuff and friend deals don't really work too well. What you need is an actual professional doing that. So, you know, I would say maybe starting in 2013, probably 2013 was when we started bringing our dedicated front of house guy, so our front of house engineer, out on tour with us. And then we sort of switched crew members. We kind of, we had one guy and then he quit and then another guy, and then he moved on to a bigger band and kind of went through them a little bit. But yeah, it's other than like labels and stuff, it's been the entire touring career having at least one other person out there in the van with us, sort of helping us with the logistical stuff. Because it's just too tiring to do all of it on your own. But yeah, I don't know. A lot of people have kind of been on tour with us. It's been nice, actually.
So, okay. So when you started touring, basically, is when you started bringing in outside help.
Pretty much right away, yeah.
And so what would you say, like any tips for bands that might be just starting that phase where they're just maybe planning their first tour or like just getting into that phase of their band? Do you have any tips for them?
It really depends on geographically where they are, because I know that my advice would be very different for someone in Vancouver than it would be for someone in Toronto than it would be for someone in LA. So if you're a band in Vancouver, geographically you're in a very tough spot unless you spend a lot of money to pay work visas for the States. So you have to spend, I think for Canadians, for a five-piece band, it's about $2,000 to $3,000. And that gives you about 30 days or however many shows you have booked. So that is an expense that not a lot of bands really can sort of do right away. So that's why I always suggest do Canada, even though it sucks, even though it's not as, I mean, I love Canada, but the drives are just really bad. And there's a lot of distances between shows that just, you're not going to make any money there. It's not as glamorous, but Canadians love Canadian musicians. And if you build up that Canadian market, then it's really valuable for you in the long run. If you're on the East Coast of Canada, you have a lot of population centers. And the West Coast in Vancouver, it's Vancouver, Kelowna, kind of the city that's kind of northeast of Vancouver. And you have Calgary and Alberta. And then after that, you have some big dead areas. Winnipeg is okay. Regina is kind of okay. Then there's not a lot after that until you get to Toronto or Ottawa or whatever. If you're in the States, it's a little bit different because there are so many bands. At least in Canada, you have a little bit less of the oversaturated market when it comes to metal bands or whatever kind of band you're in. But yeah, for the most part, metal bands are touring around. There's not that many of them really, but in the US there's so many. So yeah, I mean, starting touring, I think our first thing after we kind of got over the, now we can play a show, what do we do now? How do we build our brand? Now that we know we're okay live, kind of get what we're doing here. Our first order of business was make it seem like we are not a local band. So a lot of bands put emphasis on opening for bigger bands. They go, oh man, how do I get on bigger shows when they come through my town? My suggestion is don't do that, because you get paid almost nothing to play in front of a crowd who probably doesn't want to necessarily see you. And it doesn't do a lot for you business-wise, because most of those touring bands don't really watch the opening bands anyway. So I say build up your own brand and make it seem like you are not from the town that you are, that you're from. Because when you come back and play your hometown show for the first time in a year, somebody goes, oh, I didn't even know you were from here. And that's the kind of comment that you really want. People to go, I thought you were from somewhere else. This is, you know, those are the kinds of things that, you know, people think that you're a bigger band or whatever, think that you're more special to go see or whatever, rather than just playing every weekend at the same bar, which is a trap that a lot of bands fall into. So
when does it make sense to do that though, Dean? Because I know you guys had opened up for a few, when at least when I lived in Vancouver, I'm sure I saw you guys open for a bigger band a decade ago at least.
We opened for Cannibal Corpse in 2012, and that was a crazy experience. Yeah. At the Commodore in Vancouver, and that was great. In 2010, we might have opened for one or two shows, 2011, that kind of thing. But it was pretty quickly after that that we realized, like, opening a single show, it's not really the end all be all. Some bands, you know, they put a lot of emphasis on it, but I think putting less emphasis on that and more emphasis on building yourself as a band that people want to go see rather than a band just that just so happens to be on the bill, I think is very important.
Love it. I love it.
Opening slots on tour, that's different. That is very helpful and important, because then you see day to day, every single day, what those bigger bands do, and you can mold yourself to, okay, they do this, let's do that. That band is bigger than us, why aren't we doing this thing? That stuff is very important, but you're going to struggle to find someone that is in a bigger band than you that is interested in spending their time helping you do your craft.
Boom. That's probably the key point.
So you are your biggest advocate. So yeah, I mean, and also every band is different too. You got to find out what makes your band, if your band has that special kind of thing. And again, it kind of goes down to the content creation. Do you have an idea of what the band is? Can you distill it down to a sentence? Can you go like, our band is this? Because if you can, then you might have something. If you go, yeah, our band is kind of a mix and match of this and this and this, and it's kind of this, but we have one song that's kind of progressive and one song's, it's like, well, that might be a harder sell. I think it's easier to develop and convey simpler messages and simpler ideas, rather than sort of more, more, I don't know, convoluted, maybe not so streamlined, maybe not so, like, the look on stage is very important. The sound is very important. You need to sell yourself and the band. And it's almost like stand-up comedians is very important when they go on stage, that the audience knows who they are and what they're talking about. So you need to sell it to them immediately. You need to go, the first line or the second line has to tell the audience who you are, why you're there, what kind of person you are. So as a band, you have to get your vibe across to the audience right away. And for us, it's always been, we're the fastest band in the world. We're the craziest band. Holy shit. You see this band, it's insane. It's so technical and whatever. But for us, we also want to keep catchy melodies. We want to keep hooks. We want to write songs that people are, they can listen to again and again without getting tired of the shredding, of the blasting, of the nonsense. You know, we want to write something that people actually still really enjoy. So
which you
we
do.
Pepper in,
yeah.
Well, thank you. We pepper in the crazy stuff, and we also put in the melody, and we put in the hooks, and we put in the chorus-y kind of stuff. And all of that kind of comes together to people listen to us. They go, this is the fastest band in the world. Plus they have enjoyable hooks. And guess what? We're not the fastest band in the world, because I'm sure there's a faster band than us somewhere, but it's not really about exact numbers. It's like, if you like our band, then, you know, it gives you that kind of feeling. Oh man, this band makes me feel like this. I think that's one of the most important things about selling stuff too, is you have to give someone, you can't sell the technical specifications of something as much as well as you can sell just the feeling that you get when you have it, or you hear it, or you experience it. Yes. The emotion, that's the stuff that really gets to people. And as a beginner band, it's really tough to know where the line is and how to, you know, it takes a while. I mean, some people, we just had a meeting with somebody the other day, and they said they consider us a young band. And we've been playing since 2009. So this stuff takes a long time. It takes a really long time.
I think we're running out of time, Aaliyah.
We are, but were you going to ask something?
No, we're going to have to see if we can have Dean back at some point in the future, I think, because it's going to take way too long.
Okay. This was an absolute pleasure and so much great info in it. Thanks again for coming on.
No problem.
I kind of want to ask one more question.
Yeah, that's fine.
If you can answer relatively succinctly, I guess.
Oh, I'll try. It's hard for me to do that sometimes. Sorry.
No, but you went over this. You did go over this in your touring video on YouTube, kind of, for your European tour, how you selected the lineup, the package, the other bands to be on the package. But here's the thing. We're kind of combining these two topics of like a band for just starting out planning a first tour. They're not going to be on the same level as you guys are right now. And they're not going to be able to offer the same kind of benefits. Maybe I should try and ask the question fast, and I'm not doing a very good job.
That's okay.
Any advice for bands who are trying to plan their first tour on how to find other bands to tour with?
It really depends on the size, because I want our show to be a party. We want people to come to our show and go, fuck, that was fun. Man, that was so much fun. I got to see all these bands. They're all diverse. They're all a little different. But man, I'm not tired of metal. I'm excited. I'm amped up. And I want more. They leave wanting a little bit more. So we find bands that represent a certain aspect of our music that we touch a little bit on. So we'll have a brutal death metal band, and we'll have a deathcore band, and we'll have, you know, kind of a thrashier band or whatever. And they're all dynamic enough, and they're different from us. And they don't, we're not going to invite Archspire 2.0 on tour with us, because that would be self-defeating. That'd be kind of strange. So finding bands that to tour with when you're brand new, it's tough, because creating that party, creating that night out, that sort of even that destination where somebody wants to drive 2, 3, 4 hours or even fly to see, the budget isn't there.
Right.
So you have to rely on how good of a band are you live? How good are you? How good is your set? How good is the personality of the vibe of this band to get people to come out the next time and bring their friends? But for us, even when we were, you know, considerably smaller, building a show that is a party where, I mean, if you come to one of our shows, you will never hear death metal in between the bands as they set up or tear down or change over. You'll never hear death metal because it's too much. It's too much. You're hearing death metal. I'll go to shows and I'll be like, why are they playing death metal in between the death metal bands? That is too much, dude. Everything is considered, you know, the stuff we do in between songs. We don't have our vocalist talking in a death metal voice. We have him doing the opposite of the thing that we're doing when we're playing music. We play music, we play proficiently, we play very fast, we play technical music. And then in between songs, we have our vocalist telling really stupid jokes and acting really stupidly on stage. And he does wacky stuff. And it's fun. And there's audience interaction, there's participation. Because then you can experience the music without being too tired of it. And we don't play super long sets too. We try to keep it nice and short so that when somebody sees us, the last song comes on, they go, man, it's done already. I got to see them next time. So develop your party. If that's the vibe that you're going for your show, your night out, that's at a smaller band, it's tough to get that budget to do it. But you know, as soon as you can, really think about it like not just a show, but like the reason why someone would have to get a babysitter for their kids. Why would they do that? So to keep that in consideration.
Great points. All great note to end on. Everyone listening, I hope you learned something. And until next time, make like a bull and throw those horns up.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please help spread the word by following or subscribing to us, recommending it to your friends, or leaving us a review on your platform of choice. Thank you for listening to Heavy Business, brought to you by C-Squared Music.